This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Into the Beautiful North, written by Luis Alberto Urrea, read by Susan Erickson.
Part 1. Sur. Chapter 1. The bandidos came to the village at the worst possible time. Of course, everyone in Mexico would agree that there is no particularly good time for bad men to come to town. But Tres Camarones was unguarded on that late summer's day when so many things had already changed. And everything that remained was about to change forever. Nobody in the village liked change. It had taken great civic upheaval to bring electricity to Tres Camarones, for example. Until 1936, ice came in big trucks, and fathers took their sons to observe it when it slid down the ramps in great clear blocks. It took the visionary mayor, García García I, to see the potential for electrical power, and he had lobbied for 2 years to have the wires strung from far via Unión. Still, there were holdouts a good decade after Tres Camarones had begun to glow with yellow light. Such stalwarts relied on candles, kerosene lamps, and small bonfires in the street. These blazes, though festive, blocked the scant traffic and the trucks bearing beer and sides of beef, and García García had to resort to the apocalyptic stratagem of banning street fires entirely. Denounced as an antichrist, he was promptly defeated in the next election. Later, he was re-elected. Even if his policies had been too modernizing for some, the residents of Tres Camarones realized that a new mayor meant change, and change was the last thing they wanted. Progress might be inevitable, but there was no reason they should knuckle under without a fight. True, the occasional hurricane devastated the low-lying forest and semi-tropical jungles and reformed the beaches. Often, parts of the town were washed away or carried out to sea. But the interior clock of evolution in Tres Camarones was set only to these cataclysms of nature. And then the peso dropped in value. Suddenly there was no work. All the shrimp were shipped north. Tortillas became too expensive to eat, and people started to go hungry. "We told you change was bad," the old-timers croaked. Nobody had heard of the term immigration. Migration, to them, was when the tuna and the whales cruised up the coast, or when Wakamaja parrots flew up from the south. Traditionalists voted to revoke electricity, but it was far too late for that. No woman in town would give up her refrigerator, her electric fan, or her electric iron. So the men started to go El Norte. Nobody knew what to say. Nobody knew what to do. The modern era had somehow passed Tres Camarones by, but this new storm had found a way to siphon its men away, out of their beds and into the next century, into a land far away. The bandidos came with the sunrise, rolling down the same eastern road that had once brought the ice trucks. There were two of them. They had to drive south from Mazatlan, which was at least 1 hour and 40 minutes away, then creak off the highway and take the cutoff toward the coast. Explosions of parrots, butterflies, and hummingbirds parted before them. They didn't notice. One of them was an agent of the Policía Estatal, the dreaded Sinaloa state police. He earned $150 a month as a cop. The drug cartel in the north of the state paid him $2,500 a month as an advisory fee. He got a $15,000 bonus each Christmas. The other was a bottom-level narco who, nevertheless, was the state cop's boss. What he really needed to get ahead in his game was a territory to call his own. But the cartel had the state sewn up, and there was no room for him in Baja California, Sonora, or Chihuahua. He had hit the drug gangster's glass ceiling, and it irked him, because he looked so damned good. The boys called him Scarface. He liked that. In spite of the awful heat and soggy air of the coastal swamplands, he wore a white sport jacket and regarded the world through mirrored sunglasses, sucking on a cinnamon toothpick. Neither of the two bandidos enjoyed this bucolic trip to the bottomlands, but the one in the jacket had gotten a cell phone call from Culiacan that there were gringo surfos camping on the beach who were in need of some bud. He shook his head as he looked out at the stupid mango trees. All this trouble for marijuana. "It's a job," Scarface said. The cop snorted. Scarface wore his irritating chrome automatic in a shoulder rig. It made his armpit and ribs into a swamp of perspiration. It was against the law for a Mexican to carry an automatic weapon, though he didn't even think about it. His partner wore a uniform and had a heavy Bulldog 44 in a Sam Brown holster. The narco could smell its leather and was irritated by its squeaking as the car bumped along the bad road. The holster squeak was the closest they could get to a theme song. There was nothing on the radio out here except the crappy Mexican music on AM. "Me gusta Kanye West," the narco said, snapping off the radio. The state cop said, "Diddy es mejor." "Diddy?" cried Scarface. They argued for a few moments. Soon they reverted to silence. The cop turned up the AC. His gun belt squealed. "Dios mío," Scarface sighed. "I hate the country." The men kept their windows rolled up, but they could still smell the ripe effluent of mud and clams and pigsties and spawning fish in green water. They wrinkled their noses. "What is that?" the cop asked. "Boiling mangoes?" They shook their heads, greatly offended. The other one pointed. "Outhouses," he scoffed. They couldn't believe it. These towns were so backward, Emiliano Zapata and a bunch of revolutionaries could ride through at any moment and fit right in. The bandidos, a generation removed from outhouses, sneered at the skinny dogs and the absurd starving roosters that panicked as the car rolled over oyster shells and brushed aside sugarcane and morning glory vines. The rubes down here had apparently never heard of blacktop. It was all dirt roads and cobblestones. No tourists. They were slightly pleased, yet jealous, when they noted one of the small houses had a satellite dish. Like the neighborhoods of most tropical Mexican villages, the walls of the homes in town went right to the edge of the street. Walls were wavery and one block long, and several doors could be found in each. Each door denoted another address. The windows had big iron railings and wooden shutters. Bougainvillea cascaded from several roof lines. Trumpet flowers, lantana. The bandidos knew that the back of each house was a courtyard with a tree and an open kitchen, and some more chickens and an iguana or two. Laundry. On the street side, the walls were great splashes of color. One address might be white, while the next might be pale blue and the next vivid red with a purple door. Sometimes two primary colors were divided by a bright green drain pipe or a vibrating line where the colors clashed and the human eye began to rattle in its socket. The big police LTD rolled down the streets like a jaguar sniffing for its prey. The two visitors came out of the narrow alleys into the open space of the town plazuela, a tawdry gazebo and a bunch of trees with their trunks whitewashed. On the other side of the square, they spied a restaurant, Taqueria y Internet, La Mano Caída. "The Fallen Hand Taco Shop? What kind of a name is that?" the cop asked. "It's an internet cafe, too," the narco reminded him. "Jesus Christ!" "Let's get out of here quick," his partner said. "I want to catch the baseball game in Mazatlan tonight." He spit out his toothpick. They creaked to a halt and could hear the music blasting out of the Fallen Hand before they even opened the car's doors. Chapter 2. Here came Nayeli, late for work again, dancing through town on her way to the Fallen Hand. She didn't mean to dance. It's just that everywhere she went, she swung and swayed, and it was all she could do to keep herself from running. She had been the star forward of the Tres Camarones girls' soccer team for 4 years, and even though she'd been out of high school for a year, she was still in shape. Her dark legs were hard with muscle, and she still wore her tiny school uniform skirt so everybody could admire. Besides, clothes didn't grow on trees. Nayeli was dreaming of leaving town again. She wanted to see anything, everything. Wanted to go where lights changed color, where airplanes lumbered overhead, and the walls of great buildings were covered in television screens, like in that Bill Murray Japanese movie they'd seen at the Cine Pedro Infante the week before. She wanted shimmering lines of traffic and city rain. She was eager to see a concert, ride a train, wear fancy clothes, and sip exotic coffees on a snowy boulevard. She had seen elevators in 1,000 movies, and she longed to ride one, though not on the roof of one like Jackie Chan. Sometimes she dreamed of going to the United States, Los Unaites, as the people of the town called them, to find her father who had left and never come back. He traded his family for a job, and then he stopped writing or sending money. She didn't like to think about him. People kidded her that she never stopped smiling, and it made her look flirty, but thinking about him made the smile fade. She walked faster. Nayeli was coming from Aunt Irma's campaign headquarters, located in the stifling kitchen of Irma's house on Avenida Francisco Madero. Irma, sick and tired of the ancient mayor of Tres Camarones, "That smelly old man," she often complained, was making history by running to replace him in the next election. It would be a first. Irma Garcia Cervantes, the first female municipal president of Tres Camarones. It had an excellent ring to it. She had leadership experience. Aunt Irma was Sinaloa's retired lady bowling champion, and she was used to celebrity and the heat of the public's attentions. If political power was not her destiny, she reasoned, it could only mean the good Virgin herself had dictated that Mexico should continue its slide into chaos and ruin. One of Nayeli's main tasks was to write with fat sidewalk chalk, "Aunt Irma for President," on walls all around Tres Camarones. As campaign manager, she earned 20 pesos a week, proving that Aunt Irma, too, had that affliction detested by Sinaloans, yet epidemic in proportion. They called it el codo duro, the hard elbow, or the unbending elbow. Unbending when it came time to spend money. 20 pesos! You couldn't even afford corn tortillas anymore on 20 pesos. The Americans were buying up all the maize for fuel, and none of the rancheros could afford to use it for food. What did come down to the people was too expensive to purchase. So Nayeli danced on down the street to her second job, serving tacos and soft drinks at La Mano Caída. "Let's eat," the cop said. They had gotten restless, waiting for the damned Americano surfos to show up. They had a brick of pot in the trunk of their car, and the clock was ticking. He tapped on the bar. Tacho, the Fallen Hands taco master, glowered. "What you got?" the cop asked. Tacho was tired of the thugs. They glared too much for his taste. "Food," he said. The narco smiled. "You're kind of mouthy for a queer." Tacho shrugged. "He's a queer?" the cop said. "He's wearing eye makeup," said Scarface. "I thought he was one of those emo kids you hear about," the cop shrugged. "Emo sucks," Scarface muttered. "I like Diddy," the cop reminded him. Tacho had just about had it, but suddenly Nayeli burst through the doors. "You're late," Tacho scolded. "I'm sorry, Tachito mi amor," she called, automatically falling into her flirting banter with him. "Tachito machito mi angelito." The gunman snorted. "Little Tacho, my little macho, my little angel." That was too rich. They nudged each other. "You're macho, eh?" the cop said. "A macho angel." They giggled. "Eres joto?" the narco asked. Because if this hot little girl was talking to him like that, he might not be a queer after all. Tacho made eyes at Nayeli. She hurried to tie on a white apron. She saw the silver glint of the narco's .45 peeking out from behind his jacket. "Take a table," Tacho said. "No need for gentlemen like yourselves to have to sit at the bar." He smiled at them. It looked like he was getting a tooth pulled, but anything to get them across the room from him. He didn't want to have them near enough to smell their tacky cologne. One of them was wearing Old Spice. They sat at one of Tacho's quaking little tin Carta Blanca tables. "What do you recommend?" the cop asked Nayeli.
"Tacho's fried oyster tortas are a legend," she replied.
"Sounds good." She turned away. He grabbed her hand and pulled her back. "You," he said, "you're under arrest." She felt a pure cold bolt of panic.
"Excuse me?"
"You're under suspicion," he sneered, "of stealing my heart." He let her go and sent her back across the room on a gale of laughter. Her face was burning. Tacho whispered to her, "Viejo feo," ugly old man. It was one of his favorite insults. "Good one," the narco was saying. They kept laughing, wiping their eyes. "Hey," he called, "girl, bring us some drinks." Tacho sighed. "It's going to be one of those days," he said. Nayeli fished two beers out of the vat of ice at the end of the bar. The men scared her. She tried to think about other things when she was tense or afraid. Better days. Before things had turned so sad. Before everyone had become so poor. She opened the beer bottles, served them, and rushed to the end of the bar while Tacho started frying up the oysters. The narco pulled his big pistol out of the shoulder holster and laid it on the table. He held open his jacket and flapped his arm a little. He turned his head and eyed Nayeli. He patted the gun and smiled at her.
"Está caliente, la chaparra," he noted.
The cop glanced over at her to see how hot the shorty really was.
They studied her legendary legs. Her bright white teeth against the deep cinnamon brown of her skin made her smile radiate like moonlight on water. "A little dark," he said, "but she'll do." He winked at her and sipped his icy beer. Nobody was quite sure if Tres Camarones was in Sinaloa or Nayarit, since the state line wavered in and out of the mangrove swamps and lagoons thereabouts. There was no major highway going through. There was no local police station, no hotel or tourist trap. No harbor, no television or radio station, no police station, no supermarket. The high school was in Villa Union, a long, sweaty bus trip away. The church was small and full of fruit bats. Of course, there was a small Carta Blanca beer distributor. But come to think of it, the office had shut down when the men went north to find work. It was easier to float a boat down the tributaries of the Baluarte River than it was to drive the dirt road spur that angled southwest off the highway to Rosario. At any rate, nobody had ever worried about maps. On the official Pemex highway guides, Tres Camarones didn't even exist. The American boys, who started it all by making a peeved Chiba call to their Mazatlan connection, seeking a key of gold bud, were on spring break from some college in California. They had wandered down the coast looking for good surfing and party spots, and they'd made the error of picking the sugar-white beaches outside Tres Camarones for their camp. The locals could have told them, but didn't, that the picturesque beaches belied a brutal drop-off, and the waves hammered against a nearly vertical wall of underwater mud. Other hazards abounded. The nearest popular beach was called Caimanero, because big alligators lurked in the foul freshwater swamps behind the shore. Not a spot for frolic. Portuguese man-o-wars floated onto the beaches all summer, killing everything they could sting. There was a spoiling porpoise carcass on the sand to bear testimony to their powers. The best salt water in that whole region was in the shallow turquoise lagoons, where the women went crabbing with floating straw baskets full of scrabbling jaibas, the big crabs taking their last little sea cruise before landing in the cooking pot. But you couldn't surf a tranquil lagoon. It wasn't like the people hadn't seen Americanos. Tres Camarones had been beset upon by tides of missionaries from Southern California. But the Jesús es mi fiel amigo Sunday school and the End Times Templo Evangelico had finally closed down for lack of converts. The Youth Center went back to being a muffler shop that was also closed because its owner had gone to Florida to pick oranges. For a short while, an ashram run by a Wisconsin woman named Crystal, who was in constant channeling contact with a Venusian UFO knot, Patak, rose north of town. Several local workers had made good wages working on Crystal's pink cement pyramid on her leased 40 acres of scrub and pecan trees. But the local water cut short Petok's mission to the world, and Crystal rushed back to Sheboygan with typhoid and amoebic dysentery. After Crystal's personal rapture, the Jehovah's Witnesses, known as Los Testigos de Jehová, were forced to leave town when the heroic local bowling champion, Aunt Irma, unleashed her devilish tongue upon them and christened them Los Testículos de Jehová. The witnesses, deeply offended, packed up their Spanish editions of Watchtower and abandoned the heathens to their grisly fate. Scarface tossed aside his napkin. The lime juice and Cholula sauce were better when you sucked them off your fingers. The table was a wasteland of empty plates. He stood. "Where are these pinches gringos?" he shouted.
The state cop checked his watch, put down his beer bottle, and turned to glare at Tacho as if the proprietor was the surfer's secretary.
"We are busy men," he warned. "I've been here an hour," Scarface complained.
Tacho shrugged. "You know how Americans are," he said, "always late, on their own time." Scarface kicked back his chair and grabbed his gun. He held it down by his side, as if deciding whether Tacho and Nayeli needed shooting.
"If the surfos show up, tell them next time we see them, they each get a bullet in the head. Understand? I don't like to be kept waiting."
"Si, senor," Nayeli replied.
The bad men strode out and got back in their car. Scarface pulled a fresh cinnamon toothpick out of his breast pocket. He took off the cellophane wrapper, dropped it on the floor, and popped the toothpick in his mouth. It waggled up and down.
"Nice town," he said. "No cops?"
He adjusted his lapels.
"No men. Did you notice?"
He smiled.
"A vato like me could make a real killing here."
He wiped his sunglasses on his shirt and put them back on.
"Watch yourselves," he called out the window,
then drove away without paying. Chapter 3. As the bandidos prowled the town and its outskirts, Tacho and Nayeli went about their day, mopping the cement floor, sweeping off the sidewalk in front, slicing limes and peeling mangoes. But mostly, they did what Mexicans in every small town in Mexico did. They circled their own history. Nayeli was thinking about the missionaries. Well, she was thinking about one of them. The one saint, Missionary Matt. All of Nayeli's notorious girlfriends loved Missionary Matt. He was the first blonde boy any of them had ever seen in person. They could claim that the vapid white boy handsomeness of El Brad Pitt or El Steve McQueen at the cinema didn't move them. But up close, it was a different story. A real live blue-eyed white boy was their own romantic freak show. Matt's nose peeled. They had never seen peeling noses. It was precious. Matt snuck away from his pastoral duties every night and crept into the Cine Pedro Infante. Nayeli's girlfriends were not the only ones who sat in restless groups all around him, tittering over his slightest jest. Even mothers and aunties tittered, "Ay, Mateo," whenever he said anything. That boy was movie crazy. Matt had endeared himself to the many girls in town by writing their names phonetically on 4x6 cards. When he left behind 100 broken hearts as he distributed these well-thumbed cards to his sweethearts as farewell gifts, with his address and phone number written on the back of each. The card was the closest thing to a love letter Nayeli had ever received. She pulled it for inspection, the ink a little diffuse from her sweating. It read, "Na-yel-e." Beneath this, it said, "Love, Matt." Then, an address and a phone number that started with an 858 prefix. Love, Nayeli thought. She knew enough English to know that. Love. Was it love-love? Like, love? Or was it just love? Like, mi amigo Mateo love? Like, I love my sister or my puppy or peanut butter cups love? Hello, Tacho said. Work, like, sometime today? Oh, you, she said dreamily. Tacho raised his hands and seemed to beseech the universe. Nayeli kept Missionary Matt's card stuck in her knee sock along with the sole tattered postcard her father had sent her from a place called Kankakee, Illinois. It showed a wild turkey gazing with deep paranoia out of a row of corn stalks. Before he'd fled to Kankakee, Don Pepe had been the only police officer in Tres Camarones. Mostly, he directed traffic and inspected the rare car wreck on the eastern road. Nayeli's father had been gone 3 years. When it really got hot, and she was sweaty enough to threaten the ink altogether, she reluctantly tucked the two cards in her mirror at home. She wandered out on the sidewalk and swept listlessly. The scant, heavy river breeze stirred her tiny skirt. Boys used to whistle at Nayeli when she went by, but she'd been noticing a silence in the streets. Perhaps 19 was already too old. Everything was changing for her. There was nowhere for a champion futbolista to go if she was a girl, and it was out of the question for her to head off to Culiacan or somewhere else expensive to attend the university. Her mother took in laundry. But really, all the old women of Tres Camarones took in laundry. It would take many more dirty and lazy people to sustain the home laundry industry. Fortunately, Nayeli and her mother received some assistance from the formidable Tia Irma, the future municipal president. Tia Irma's pro-bowling winnings had been sufficiently vast that she had actually invested most of her money, and was further comfortably attended to by monthly retirement checks from her hard years at the canneries. The checks were modest, but she didn't need much more than Domino cigarettes, the occasional bottle of rum, and a steady diet of tachos, tacos, and tortas. It was Tia Irma, known to the notorious girlfriends as La Osa, the she-bear, who pushed Nayeli into football. And it was both Irma and Don Pepe who enrolled Nayeli in Dr. Matsuo Gray's martial arts dojo when the other girls were taking dance lessons for the various pageants and balls at the Club de Leones. Karate, Tia Irma insisted, was good for the legs, power on the field. But Nayeli was not fooled. To La Osa, life and love were war, and she expected Nayeli to win as many battles as possible. Aunt Irma wanted her to beat up men. Missionary Matt had taught Nayeli a term for Tia Irma. Es muy hardcore, La Osa. Ay, Mateo, Nayeli said out loud. He was on some glorious California beach, and she was at Tacho's. It was a job, at least. It gave her money for shoes or movie tickets at the cine. Since Matt had donated his satellite laptop to Tacho when he left, the taqueria had been transformed into an internet cafe. Nayeli sashayed in and tossed the broom in the corner. I'm going on el internet, she announced. Do you think I pay you to play on the computer all day? Tacho scolded. Yes. Cabrona. Tacho was cranky like this with all the girls. It was part of his routine. A man like Tacho had to learn to survive in Mexico, and he had learned to recreate himself in bright colors, in large attitudes, thus becoming a cherished character. If he wanted to achieve immortality, or at least acceptance in Tres Camarones, the best thing to do was become an amazing fixture. It was very macho to be a ne'er-do-well, even if you were gay. That's why mewling missionaries didn't stand a chance. Being meek wasn't macho. There was no legend there. For years, the joke about Tacho's kind, los jotos, was that they suffered from the affliction of la mano caída, the fallen hand, the cartoony limp wrist of the gay man in the common pantomime. Just the phrase made people laugh. Except for Tacho. He didn't accept being called faggot by anybody, except his girls. And he certainly didn't feel that he was limp-wristed in any way. So he threw it back in their faces by naming his establishment the Fallen Hand Cafe. Genius! Even the most macho men in town had embraced him immediately, because he was wittier than they were, and because of this, somehow more macho. That was years ago. Lately, the Mano Caída mostly attracted bored old ladies with very little money or Nayeli's troublesome bratty girls, and they never spent a peso. All they wanted to do was look at gringo boys on the internet. He sighed. What a life. At least he also sold women's shoes from his back bedroom over on Avenida Benito Juarez. Nayeli wasn't the only one who could work Mateo's computer. Indeed, Tacho had found eBay, and he had begun his second career with the help of Tia Irma's American Express card. Thanks to Tacho, Tres Camarones was now treated to a monthly visit from bright yellow DHL delivery trucks, an exotic touch that made the citizens feel cosmopolitan. Tacho and Nayeli shared a lust for big cities. Any big cities. They used the computer to spy on New York, London, Madrid, Paris. Sometimes, after work, they climbed on the roof of the restaurant to watch the bats. They made believe that clouds were the Manhattan skyline. "Oh, no," groaned Tacho. "Here come the rest of them." The notorious girlfriends, what was left of them, were walking up the sidewalk. They were yelling adios to everybody they knew on the street. People in Tres Camarones didn't say hello. They said goodbye. Nayeli looked out and grinned. There were only three of them left, but they liked to brag that they were the best of the bunch. Cookies Cristerna had moved to Culiacán. Sachiko Uzeta Amano had gone to Mexico City to learn how to make movies. María de los Ángeles Hernández Osuna was studying to be a doctor in Guadalajara. Now it was just Nayeli, Yolo Xochitl, and Veronica. Yolo Xochitl's phonetic missionary map card read, "Yo-lo-so-sheet." He called her Yo-Yo, which amused him to no end. Her parents had been infected with folklore mania, a real danger among liberal Mexicans with college educations. Her father had made it through 1 year of university, and thus well connected to his Toltec past, he and Yolo Xochitl's mother had decided to christen their offspring with Nahuatl names. Fortunately for everyone, they'd only had two children. Unfortunately for her older brother, they had named him Taloc. Young Taloc didn't enjoy being known as the rain god. Every time he went to pee, his friends made relentless jokes. So he changed the name to Lab before he went north to become nameless with his father. Matt had already known how to say Veronica, but just to make her feel good, he'd made one out for her, too. Veronica. Lately, Yolo Xochitl had been working as a pin tender at the three-lane bowling alley down by the statue of Benito Juarez. Veronica worked as a shrimp peeler in the stinking estuaries north of town. Neither one liked her job. Too much sweat. Yolo Xochitl wore her faded El Tri Rock and Roll t-shirt and some gaucho pants Tacho had sold her for half price. Her mother had saved for a year to get her out of glasses. Her contact lenses had unleashed the fashion model inside her. She was carrying another one of her paperback books. Yolo, as the girls all called her, was always reading. As usual, everybody was staring at Veronica, the only goth girl in Sinaloa. She had made her face pale with various ointments and creams, and she had painted her eyelids dark, her lips black, her nails black. She wore a long black skirt that must have been stifling, yet she managed to radiate cool air when she walked by. Veronica ironed her hair so it hung down like a sheet of satin. Her hair was already utterly black, but she also dyed it with black number one rinse, just like her heroes in Type O Negative, whose videos she'd seen with Nayeli on YouTube. It was much harder for girls to become astounding characters in the fabric of Tres Camarones culture. They were mostly, if they were eccentric, seen as outrageous monsters. But Veronica's every public appearance was a shock. She had been a goth for 3 months. Before that, she had dreamed of being a pop star in revealing hot pants and see-through blouses of televised Latin American variety shows. She was going to dye her hair that plasticine coppery color that passed for blonde among Mexican starlets. Only the notorious girlfriends noted that she'd gone goth after her father and brother had left. Everyone called her La Vampira. The girls burst through the door, popping gum and clanking bracelets. "Tachito, mi flor!" trilled Yolo. Normally, Tacho would flick anyone who called him a flower with his deadly washcloth. "Tramp," he replied, not meanly. "Yolo," Nayeli called. "Que onda, mora?" Yolo replied, delighting in street slang. Sounding like a city tough was so rock and roll. She was the best student among them. If she had been able to, she would have studied dentistry in college. She, too, was a soccer star, though Nayeli had overshadowed her on the field.
"Hola, Nayeli," sighed La Vampira.
"Vampi," Nayeli said. "How is life, Vampi?"
"Sad," said La Vampira.
She pulled a rosary from her black beaded clutch purse. "Tacho's Fashion Emporium, 155 pesos." The beads rattled on the table.
"I don't know how much more I can take."
Yolo and Nayeli looked at each other and rolled their eyes. Tacho, a sucker for the goth routine, made up a small bowl of mango and pineapple and orange slices with red chili powder on them and sat with La Vampira and poked toothpicks into the fruit.
"Eat," he said. "You've got to eat, my angel."
"Oh, Tacho,"
she breathed. She squeezed his hand weakly.
"She's an angel," muttered Nayeli. "Angel of death, maybe."
Yolo snorted.
"You snorted," Nayeli said. "I so did not snort."
Nayeli clicked the keys and opened a video of a skateboarder getting hit in the crotch by his board on Google Video. She made a face and switched websites.
"Ah, Captain Jack Sparrow."
Yolo leaned against Nayeli's shoulder. She turned to La Vampi and said,
"Oi, Vampi. La Nayeli is going to marry Johnny Depp."
"Capitán Jack Sparrow," Vampi said.
"Oh, yes," Tacho agreed. "Es muy caliente el Capitán Jack."
Veronica made a face.
"Me encanta," Nayeli said. "I love him."
"Me too," Tacho said.
"Jack Espero," Vampi said, "needs a bath."
She waved her hand dismissively.
"Besides," she added, "I can only marry one man." Not again, muttered Nayeli.
She grumbled and went to YouTube. Veronica had never even seen gothic people before she had watched Nayeli work Tacho's computer. But as soon as she saw wand boys and mascara, she was lost. Type O negative was awesome, or chido, as she put it. The Sisters of Mercy put her way around the bend, and now this. Nayeli huffed, then typed in the 69 eyes, thinking, why do I do this? What does that mean? Tacho asked.
He must have 69 eyes, Yolo said.
Who does?
Him,
said Nayeli, pointing to the goth band on the screen and at the cadavers sitting in their midst.
He always wears sunglasses, Vampi marveled. His name is Jirki.
The glasses hide all those eyeballs, Yolo said.
¿Qué?
Asked Tacho.
Here we go,
Nayeli said, mouse clicking to call up Vampi's favorite song, Gothic Girl. The girls started to dance. Tacho thought this Jirki person sounded like he was dead, but he sounded comfortable being a corpse, even happy.
Dance with me, boy, Nayeli commanded.
Tacho took Nayeli's hand and tried a cumbia to the music. La Vampi went crazy and started jumping up and down, bobbing her head from side to side. In her heavily accented English, she sang, I love my gothic girl. Well, what she said was, I love my gothic girl. And everyone laughed. Nayeli didn't get home until 10 o'clock. When she came in the door, her mother said, what were you doing? Nayeli said,
nothing. Just another day at work, Mommy.
How is Tacho?
Fine.
Nayeli ate some calabazas and milk, then went to bed in front of her ancient electric fan. The geckos chirped on the wall above her bed. Her mother called, we're going to the lagoon tomorrow.
Awesome,
Nayeli called. What she shouted was, chido! But her mother did not know what that newfangled word meant.
Night, Mommy.
Good night, mi hijita.
Nayeli rolled her head on the hot pillow. She was asleep before she knew it was happening. She dreamed that she lived in a big white house surrounded by trees and fountains. There was snow in the distant mountain range. Her horses were white, and the swans in her lake floated serenely as the maid served tea. She had English muffins with strawberry jam on a silver tray. She spoke perfect English. She wore a long gown and ate ice cream when she was done with the muffins. Her husband, Johnny Depp, had gold teeth, black eyeliner, and waist-length hair. Tomorrow, he said with a metallic grin, we will go to Kankakee. Chapter 4 Tia Irma headed down the street like a parade float, and they hurried to keep up with her. Crab Day, she called as she motored along the sidewalk, thinking the people who smiled at Nayeli were smiling at her. Crabbing was like going to heaven. A whole day immersed in the clear lagoon, with barrels of ice full of soda and beer, the thatch-roofed huts in the sand swinging with hammocks, the big pots boiling crabs to be eaten on stiff-fried tortillas. There was nothing better than Crab Day. They boarded the two boats at the sloping little dock. Nayeli had stopped at the graves of her grandparents and pulled a few weeds. Shy, red-legged tarantulas feeling their way between the monuments. The river water was deep green and sluggish as it moved by, carrying pollen and leaves. The banks here were dark mud, flecked with a scatter of white shells. Fat green frogs the eternally grinning types destined to be shellacked into bizarre poses while wearing mariachi hats and holding toy trumpets and guitars, and then sold in tourist traps all over Mexico, jostled lazily in the dappled shadows. Brilliant egrets and blue herons stalked the reeds on the shore. La Osa settled into the first boat, tipping it alarmingly, but refusing to note the hubbub she caused. She wore a vast straw hat upon her head, and she snapped her 10,000 picture of a tree orchid with her ancient plastic Kodak. "Each flower," she lectured, "as distinct as a snowflake." Not that any of them had ever seen a snowflake. Behind Tia Irma sat Nayeli's mother, a well-known hypochondriac since her husband left. "Maria," Irma said, "how are you today?" "Oh," Nayeli's mother said, "not very well." Irma snapped, "You've been dying for years. Why don't you get it over with?" In an hour, they had come to the bend in the river where the boats could be beached and tied to bushes, and the party disembarked and grunted over the slope, breaking suddenly, amazingly, from jungly dark to a dazzling white cove that had at its center a wide oblong lagoon of brightest turquoise. Beyond the far end of the lagoon, the thundering surf of the deadly beach could be seen, dark ocean water exploding in spray and foam with a relentless basso roar. Everything seemed woven in purest sunlight. The coconut palms bobbed with their bright green harvests nestled among the silky-looking fronds. Beyond the coconuts, hibiscus trees stood 20 feet tall, burning with crimson blossoms. Little thatched huts sagged at jaunty angles, and Nayeli wasted no time getting to them, prying open their storage boxes and unfurling the mesh hammocks stored inside. The breeze never stilled. Miraculously, no one could tell how hot it was or how humid. The faint whiffs of rotting porpoise occasionally spoiled the Edenic effect, but otherwise they had reached the most perfect spot in the world. Irma said to Maria, her sister, "Your husband should have come here before he left. He would have stayed home. En Mexico lindo." Nayeli's mother replied, "You cannot eat beauty." Yolo and Nayeli were in the lagoon. The water only came up to their hips. Tiny fish sniffed and nibbled at their thighs. Nayeli's hair was pulled back in a loose ponytail. Yolo had cut hers for the summer. On the white sand, Tacho had a fire going, and he was boiling seawater with onions and secret sauces. Yolo nudged Nayeli. Tacho was wearing a cloth wrapped around his waist like a sarong. The girls laughed. They moved deeper into the lagoon. They watched their own bellies and hips wobble and distend in the water. The reflected light made Nayeli's skin look white. She regarded it fondly. Yolo said, "Remember when Mateo the missionary came here with us?" "Aye, Matt," Nayeli sighed. "He was so cute," Yolo said. "That crab pinched his toe. He was screaming. I had to bite the crab's claw open." "Nayeli," Yolo said, "you are always the strong one."
"Do you think he remembers us?"
Yolo gestured at her own body. "Who could forget this?" she boasted. But Yolo wasn't blind. She'd seen Matt's eyes as he tried not to look Nayeli over. "You kissed him," Yolo said, poking Nayeli in the arm.
"I did not."
"Yes, you did."
"No, I didn't."
"No sea simple, Nayeli," Yolo scolded. "Everybody knows you kiss Mateo."
Nayeli smiled.
So? She said.
Yolo gasped and splashed her. So it's true! You did kiss him!
Nayeli shrugged with one shoulder. Maybe.
The kiss. Matt would remember that, she was certain. His mouth was delicious, with his cherry cola lip balm. Soft lips. Those soft curls, too, smelling like apple juice with that girl's shampoo he used.
She liked to think of Matt's mouth as having American lips.
Labios Americanos. It could be a power ballad by Maná.
La Osa's comrades were across the water moving toward them. Everyone was hunting for crabs. They each carried sticks. Between each pair of women floated a big straw basket. The notorious girlfriend's open basket already held 10 furiously scrabbling crabs. The armored creatures wrestled each other, and when one seemed about to climb out of the basket and make its escape, the others would grab it and haul it back down into the endless battle.
"Look at that," Yolo said. "They never make it out."
"That's us," Nayeli said. "That's Mexico."
"Don't let your aunt hear you say that," Yolo warned.
They shuffled their feet along the bottom, stirring bright white clouds of sand that curled like smoke around their legs. Suddenly, a huge crab burst out of the sand and scuttled along the bottom. The girls yelped and ducked underwater. Nayeli got to the crab first, and she pressed the stick to its back, holding it down. She carefully pinched it from behind, keeping well away from its powerful claws, and pulled it out of the water. She shook her head to get the water out of her eyes and said, "Look at that!"
"Hey!" Yolo said. "Es hembra!"
A female. Sure enough, the she-crab had a thick girdle of eggs plastered to her shell. Tacho would be delighted. Crab roe made a paste that moved him to orgasmic delight when he smeared it on a tortilla and soaked it in lemon juice and green salsa. Nayeli tossed it in the basket.
"Don't you feel guilty?" Yolo said.